so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Hello again, I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder, the program that provides the tools and the inspiration to make the rest of your life the best of your life, no matter what age you are now. Are you simply growing older or are you growing bolder? It's a question that we all answer every day by the way we live our lives.
And every week, we help you discover the passion and purpose in your life, and today is no exception. Coming up in just a moment, the former U.S. Surgeon General will be with us talking about making the kind of lifestyle changes that can add years to your life.
We're also going to talk with our pal Ari Seth Cohen, who has created a global movement celebrating the ageless spirit of fashion and creativity.
And one of the most inspiring survivors we've ever met. Stick around because Growing Bolder starts now. Listening to Growing Bolder, I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and our next guest was born to a poor immigrant family in New York City where he experienced, it was tough, homelessness, hunger, health issues as well. He was a high school dropout, but he still went on to become a combat-decorated Vietnam veteran as a member of our special forces. And then after the war, he went back to college, then he went on to medical school, and he became a surgeon and eventually a hospital and health system CEO.
Yeah. And that's really just the beginning. In 2002, he was nominated by the President of the United States, unanimously confirmed by the U.S. Senate to become the 17th Surgeon General of the United States. He is now a distinguished college professor, author, and president of the nonprofit Canyon Ranch Institute. I had the pleasure of meeting this gentleman at the Lake Nona Impact Forum, where he spoke about the importance of lifestyle modification and prevention in dealing with not only our personal health, but the potential health care crisis that is now facing our country, in which 10,000 of us are turning 65 each and every day. Let's welcome Dr. Richard Carmona. Hey, Doc, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thank you for that undeserved introduction that bespeaks of what a great country we live in.
Now, well, we could have gone on and on, and as much as we might want to gripe about the quality of health care, the expense of health care, the delivery of health care, the politics of health care, the bottom line is health care begins at home with personal responsibility, something that you've been telling us for decades.
Yeah, it's true. You know, I mean, it's a very complex issue because of the 320 million people all live in different economic strata, but each and every one of us has to take some personal responsibility commensurate with our resources to do so. And that is, you know, we have to make healthier choices. We have to eat healthy. We have to exercise a little every day, wear a seatbelt, wear a helmet, because what we do know is that we're spending nearly $3 trillion a year, 18 to 19% of our GDP on what we call health care. It's really sick care, because most of what we're spending our money on are diseases that are caused by our bad lifestyle choices, and that's like 75 to 80% of the budget, and most of that is preventable.
You know, I've heard you talk about health care and say that almost every day you are fighting aging and fighting gravity. Boy,
yeah.
I guess you may as well be poking your fist into a brick wall. How do you fight those things?
Well, I think the best medicine, I always say, is you keep moving throughout life. So, you know, as a Surgeon General, I'm expected to practice what I preach. And even, you know, with the long, long days in Washington, my staff and I, we had our exercise every day, an hour. You know, it might be at 5 in the morning, it might be at midnight. As I traveled, whether I stayed on a military base or on a hotel, I would get down to the little gym and do some exercise. Made healthy choices most of the time, even on the road. Doesn't have to be perfect. Never smoke. You know, there are certain things that you can do that are pretty cheap. The challenge, of course, is effecting sustainable behavioral change in a population that has a diversity of activities it chooses to do. And many of those activities contribute to the disease and economic burden we have today.
You know, you mentioned smoking, Dr. Carmona. In 2006, you released a landmark Surgeon General's report, which was the most comprehensive and authoritative report on the health effects of secondhand smoke. And in that report, you wrote, "The debate is over. The science is clear. Secondhand smoke is not a mere annoyance, but a serious health hazard. We now know that smoking can cause at least 18 different kinds of cancer, dozens of serious other chronic diseases. Why do 42 million Americans still smoke?"
Well, they're addicted, unfortunately. I mean, the good news is there has been significant change. So as we look at the post-World War II United States, where almost half the people, about 45%, were smoking. Today, about 1 in 5 people still smoke, but about 1 in 3 of our veterans and our soldiers and sailors and airmen smoke. So when you stratify, you see certain pockets where there's still a lot. Part of it is the fact that the tobacco contains nicotine, and nicotine addicts you. So as Surgeon General, I spend a lot of time on tobacco issues because it adds significantly to the disease and economic burden. And what we know is that even with the patches, nicotine patches, gum, sprays, biofeedback, that the failure rate is still very high. 95% of people try, fail, and it takes them 2 or 3 times. And during that time, sometimes they're despondent. But then there's another group of people who I used to speak to, a minority, and they'd say, well, Surgeon General, in fact, let me tell you what I used to do. I would go into buildings and I'd see people smoking outside, and I'm in uniform as Surgeon General with my staff, sometimes security people, my chief of staff, my aides, and I'd stop, and they would get embarrassed because I'd get a smoker, and I'd say, hey, what you up to? And I'd introduce myself, and I'd say, I'm the Surgeon General, guy smoking, blowing smoke in my face, and I would say, so how come you're smoking? And I said, can I see your smoking pack? And they'd show it to me, and I'd look at the bottom, and I'd say, you see here where it says Surgeon General? That's me, and I spend every night signing these things so you guys won't smoke. Why are you smoking? And what it did was engage a discussion. And most of the people would say to me, gee, Doc, I've tried. I can't quit. I'm addicted to this stuff. I've tried 3 or 4 times. So I would give them a card, a 1-800-QUIT line to call. And even if they didn't have insurance, there were people here who would help you quit. But then I'd have people that would say, you know, that's all fine and good that you're the Surgeon General, but I'm an American and I can do what I want. The problem with that is the individual's rights to smoke are now pushing up against our collective right as society because we have to pay for his care. He's going to live a decade less than he should. He's going to have emphysema, cancer, cardiovascular disease, all related to his smoking. And it's a big problem in our society.
Well, your answer to that is why you're one of the coolest and most influential guys around. And I don't want to use your, you know, take advantage of having you here to ask you something else. In this country, it's very difficult to get people to agree on anything. But one thing pretty much everybody thinks is that healthcare system needs an overhaul. It's either too expensive, the plans aren't right, the deductibles are too high, the insurance companies get to decide what treatment you get. It's really not about where we are now, but where we are going and where it's evolving to. What is the future of the healthcare system?
Well, thank you for that question. It's something near and dear to my heart. And as you may have heard me say at Lake Nona, where I broke down the disease and economic burden, how much is preventable, and I also challenged the audience because we had a fantastic audience of thought leaders that are aggregated every year at Lake Nona talking about distance learning and distance medicine and telemedicine and an interconnected healthcare system that's digitally driven, and all of that's great. But as you remember, my presentation was a little disruptive to that because many of those are my colleagues, and I admire them, and I think they are tremendous individuals. They're coming up with all these innovative ideas. But as we advance this health system of the future, and more people staying home, more and more people connected digitally so we know where they are, we know what they're doing, we know what they're eating, and all that data is being aggregated, that all helps. We can make our systems more efficient and effective. We can make them more cost-effective. We can pursue providing the best care for the most people at the least cost. But what happens if you forget the fact that if the public is not engaged, we will end up managing a sicker population better, and that the disease and economic burden won't go away? Because if we look at the cost curve, we see it continues to rise every year, and the disease burden continues to rise. So even though we're doing everything we can to streamline our systems, we can't forget that we're streamlining the systems for the benefit of those fellow citizens we call patients, and we have to get them engaged because they are part of the solution as well as being part of the problem.
That is why this guy was the Surgeon General of the U.S. And while we have you here, recent research has shown, Dr. Carmona, that baby boomers fear Alzheimer's now even more than cancer or cardiac disease. Right. You wrote a book titled Canyon Ranch, 30 Days to a Better Brain. Are there, in your estimation, proven ways to delay or perhaps even prevent the onset of dementia?
Absolutely, they are. And even if you're predisposed, I mean, the early scientific evidence is pretty clear that it starts early in life. You know, staying physically fit is one. Making sure you de-stress as much as you can. making sure you're eating a healthy diet, because that's the fuel that makes all of you, not only energy, but makes all the new cells. If you're putting junk into your body, the body uses it, but it's a suboptimal fuel, and challenging your mind throughout the life cycle. When I was a young medical student and a resident at the University of California, you know, we were told that, you know, when you get to be 60 or 70, you really can't teach the old dog new tricks. The brain's fixed. You don't make new cells. That is revolutionized over the last 30 years, and we know that that isn't true. That at 90 years old, 100 years old, you could learn to play the piano. You could learn a new language, and we can actually track that in your brain. We can see through functional magnetic resonance imaging that your brain becomes bigger, that new neural networks grow. So the idea is, if you want, the best thing that you can do to hold on to your cognitive ability, and that's not just Alzheimer's or dementia, I'm talking the average person who ages and starts forgetting things, stay engaged, stay physically active, eat healthy, de-stress, and challenge your brain throughout life. Read new things, learn a new language, you know, do exercise. Each one of those are incremental variables that will help you to preserve your cognitive function, but also your physical function, so that your body doesn't outlive your mind.
Doc, your whole life has been a challenge in itself. In the last 30 seconds, can you kind of sum up what you've seen through your eyes? What is life really about? What's the takeaway from Dr. Carmona?
I think ultimately life is about the connections we make, the love we have with other people, the caring. It's one of the most important variables as it relates to a quality of life, preserving cognitive ability, the fact that you want to stay socially connected and challenged throughout your life and be surrounded by people you care for and they care for you. That has an added survival advantage.
Amen, brother. That is Dr. Richard Carmona, the 17th Surgeon General of the U.S., one of the world's leading thought leaders on healthcare and the prevention of disease. Dr. Carmona, we greatly appreciate your time today. Thanks so much. Coming up, our Team Growing Bolder initiative designed to get you off the couch, get you moving, and greatly improve the quality of your life. That's next. Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures. Bill Schaefer and Mark Middleton here, and you're listening to Growing Bolder. One of our new initiatives this year is to help get everybody off the couch and moving on a regular basis. Did you realize even a good brisk walk can make an amazing difference in your health and your mood and your energy level and even your weight?
Which is exactly why we started something we call Team Growing Bolder. It's all about joining the movement revolution. And one of our first partners in the effort is Track Shack, which is one of the nation's top running event management companies. Track Shack has been encouraging and enabling fitness in the Central Florida area for decades now, so we joined them recently to encourage men, women, and children of all fitness levels to get moving. It's 5:30 in the morning, and the Track Shack event staff and race volunteers are setting up for another morning of fun and fitness. This time, it's the Zimmerman Kaiser Sutcliffe Winter Park Road Race presented by Florida Hospital.
I think this is fantastic. We're going to have over 4,000 runners here today.
Included in that group, many first-timers, which is why Bill Schaefer delivers a pre-race Growing Bolder pep talk.
We are going to inspire tens, hundreds, maybe thousands of other people who never in a million years would ever think about doing what you're about to do today.
While there are many who do race, for most, this is not a race. It's not even an event. It's an experience, part physical, part mental, and part social. All parts of a lifestyle that's attracting men and women of all ages, sizes, and physical conditions. The one thing they all do share is a desire to better the quality of their life by improving their overall health and fitness.
I'm 81.
81 years old, and what are you going to do today?
I'm going to run my ass off.
Jerry runs to not only celebrate his life, but to honor the lessons learned from his grandfather.
I was raised by a grandfather, and he told me that if you don't give your best, the only person you're cheating is yourself. And he says, I mean that not only in your sports, but your marriage, your job. And he picked me out of the crib when my mother died. I was 2 months old, and he was 68 years old, and he inspired me. When I have a great race, I look up, I say, see, I'm not cheating, Grandpa.
One of the top female runners in the entire field is 58-year-old Darla Bennett, who never ran at all until she was 39, surprising everyone with her speed, including her mother.
Had we known she could run like that when she was young, we would have had her trained for the Olympics.
Darla only began running after a bout with breast cancer left her determined to change her lifestyle.
It changed my whole life, my eating, my daily habits, how I ran with my children, how I trained them to eat better and live a healthier lifestyle. I'm a grandmother now, and I run with my grandkids, and it's fun. We have a lot of fun together.
She's inspired her kids, her grandkids, and even her mother to run. Four generations made healthier and happier by simply getting off the couch and moving.
She has told me that you just continue in life no matter what. You keep going. Don't let things beat you. You can beat it.
My inspiration is an 86-year-old woman, a friend of mine, who I have known for many years, and she told me every time you get nervous, just remember that you can do this.
Good job. How you feeling, honey? You okay?
Good.
That woman is Ann Call.
If you want to have a quality of life for as long as you live, keep moving.
When John and Betsy Hughes launched Track Shack events decades ago, they began a community-wide movement that continues providing an opportunity for everyone, regardless of age or ability, to improve the quality of their life.
Running has really kept me young. And, of course, most of the runners are young, so you're hanging around with young people. And that makes you feel young. So, yeah, I don't know when I'm going to be old. I hope by 95 maybe I can start acting old and be grumpy, but I just love life, and this is running has really, really been good for me.
And what about those who chose to sleep in instead of joining this celebration of health and wellness?
I wish they had come. They would have enjoyed it.
You know, it really could not have been a better day. The weather was perfect. There were many who had never participated in any event like this at all, and that made us feel great. You know, the two-mile fun run, or for many people, Bill, it was the fun walk, perfect for them. And all of the first-timers that I talked to said they would definitely be back.
And like you said, Mark, it wasn't long ago that runs like this were just for athletes or people, you know, who were real serious. But now there's a reason for anybody at any level to go, and you're welcome.
You know, my favorite part of the day, I have to say, was your pep talk early on to that group of older women, all of them afraid, not sure what to expect. They're at a race. There's lots of people around them, and you put them at ease and fired them up.
It's the most inspiring part of going to a race because we all have had a first time. Everybody's a first timer one time. And to make that decision to get off the couch and get in is the biggest win you'll have in your life. Folks, get involved in one of these races and see how much it can change your life. Well, we don't talk a lot about living forever, but we do talk a lot about living better and the time that we do have, and that's an important distinction. And Growing Bolder contributor Barbara Hannah Grufferman agrees.
Hi, I'm Barbara Hannah Grufferman, author of The Best of Everything After 50, the expert's guide to style, sex, health, money, and more. Would you want to live forever? Let's assume that such a drug existed that kept you healthy and warded off disease and other side effects of aging. It's not so far-fetched because right now as we speak in labs around the world, doctors are looking for such a discovery.
the cure, if you will, for getting old. The idea of living forever is very intriguing, but it brings with it a host of moral, ethical, and social issues, starting with, would everyone have access to this magic drug or only those who could afford it? Would we be creating a caste system based on the new game of who will live longer? And right now, the government is so financially strapped that they're cutting social services across the board. Would it be able to support a population that is growing and getting older? Well, until this becomes a reality, I'll just keep doing what I have been doing to age with grace, dignity, and health. Move my body every day, eat well, but not too much, keep connected to friends and family, stay engaged with the world, and have a good laugh at least once a day. And I'll keep in mind the words of a very dear friend who told me recently, it's the fear of aging that needs the cure.
Up next, he's done it again. How a guy with a borrowed camera, a great eye, and a passion for older people is transforming the fashion world. Ari Seth Cohen is next on Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by...
Savings accounts should build wealth, not add expenses. Raisin gives savers access to high-yield savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, and certificates of deposit from over 70 banks and credit unions. Find, fund, and manage multiple savings products all through a single secure login. More information at raisin.com/growingbolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Bolder, and we love everything about what our next guest is doing and how he's done it. You know, it all started with a borrowed camera and a personal blog in which he shared photos of fashionable older women on the streets of New York.
Yeah, he really has been a pioneer. He called that blog Advanced Style. It quickly became a best-selling book, which then led to a documentary film and now a global fashion movement. In fact, he has just written his second book. It's called Advanced Style, Older and Wiser. Welcome back to the program, Ari Seth Cohen. Hey, Ari, how are you?
Hey, guys, it's great to be back.
You know, congratulations on the new book. You've now gone global. The book also includes men, so it's obvious this is really more than a cultural phenomenon that's limited to the U.S. Are you finding that it's almost a basic need for many older people to express themselves as individuals?
Yeah, I mean, originally I was just kind of seeing the image that Americans have of older people, which tends to, you know, in America we tend to treat older people as if they're invisible. And that's a lot of the feedback that I got from men and women when I started the project. But as I've traveled, I've noticed there's similar problems and, you know, everywhere that I go. And really incredible stories to be told and wonderful people to find. And since the first book, there's been this incredible global movement where in the fashion world and in the lifestyle media world, where men and women of a certain age are now being featured all over the place in fashion campaigns and car commercials. And, you know, brands are really kind of have adopted this idea and are starting to be more inclusive with how they're showing age in the media. So that's been really incredible.
And, you know, it's because you helped open the door to make that seem cool. You know, before they were just strange people, but you made them feel cool and have panache. Has it changed over the last few years for you? I know you used to kind of just go out and you'd spot somebody and take a picture. Are people now trying to get your attention and come to you?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, my favorite thing to do is walking around and finding people organically on the street. You know, the project started out as a street style project, but now all these women have Instagram accounts and contact me on Facebook. And it's great because it kind of creates this larger conversation. And now they're using their own social media platforms to talk about aging, talk about vitality, talk about how you don't have to be invisible. You can, you know, be a creative person at any age. There, you know, it's as simple as putting on a little bit of red lipstick or playing with, you know, certain things in your closet or going out there and trying something new. It's about being adventurous and joyful and optimistic. And they continue to inspire me, all the men and women that I meet. And various avenues where I find people at this point.
You know, we love the fact that it's always been more about empowering these people than the fashion for you. But that said, Ari, someone wrote that your subjects, quote, do not abide the unspoken dictates of age appropriateness, nor subscribe to the current vogue for studied nonchalance. They are trying hard, screaming to be noticed. You don't have to be a fan of their often theatrical sartorial styles to admire their defiant spirit. And as I read that, I thought that they say the very same thing about young street style icons. In many ways, what has happened, in many ways, what you have created is a whole new genre called senior street fashion. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't really a site for that was including older people in terms of, you know, street style. I think I was one of the first or the first one. But I don't really think they're screaming to be noticed. This is the way that they've dressed for a number of years. And they don't really need that attention. It's more about they're going out in the world and expressing, you know, something that they want to every day. That's a very personal statement. And, of course, a little bit of acknowledgement goes a long way. And I think they enjoy that. But it's really about having fun with fashion. And I show a wide range of style from, you know, very elegant to very eccentric. It's really about the spirit of the person that I see walking down the street and what they're expressing in that moment. So I don't necessarily look for only men and women who dress over the top, although I think that allows people to take a step back and kind of reevaluate the fact that I don't have to give up. I don't have to wear all gray and beige clothing. I really can have fun with this. I really can bring more joy to my life. And I really have the permission to, you know, dress and act however I feel at this age.
And it was always mostly women, especially in the first book. But now you've got men.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been inspired by men. My grandmother was my best friend, and my grandfather was my best friend. And, you know, my introduction to style was going through my grandfather's closet and trying on his old Stetson hats and going to school in his, you know, shirts from the 60s and 50s and zoot suits and things like that. So, you know, this was a chance. Originally, I wanted to start with women because I feel like the portrayal of women in the media, older women especially, is very unfair. And it's not an equal balance with the way that we treat aging for women. But this book, it was about time to also include men.
We're speaking with Ari Seth Cohen, whose new book is Advanced Style, Older and Wiser. And you mentioned, Ari, that you know, you have a wide range of people in the fashion area here. And you did include Tao Porchon Lynch in your book. She's the 97-year-old yoga instructor that we've had on this program before. Style-wise, she is not as out there as many in your book. What was it about Tao that captured your attention?
Well, I met Tao at a festival in Montenegro. And as soon as I came across her, she has this incredible light that just shines from her. And, I mean, she was dressed incredibly elegant. She has a history as one of the first models. She modeled for Lanvin, you know, I think in the 1940s. And so she's wearing high heels. You know, she wouldn't leave the house without looking absolutely elegant and perfect. But more than that, it's just you can see that energy, that vitality emanating from her. And that's what this project is about, is about vitality. And as soon as she, you know, shook my hand for the first time, I felt that energy from her. She almost transferred it to me. And, I mean, she's 97 years old and teaching yoga all around the world. This is what we have to show. This is the alternative kind of aging that we have to show to people that you can be active and that you can have a very fulfilled life no matter what age you are.
And in our last 30 seconds, the big mistake people make is thinking that the book is for old people, but look what it's done to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I hear incredible feedback from young women, men who say that they're no longer afraid of aging, and then older women telling me that now all of a sudden they have a new kind of opinion of themselves and they go out there and do new things and try Pilates, like 104-year-old Ruth who's in the book. And so it's been really an honor and a privilege to meet all the men and women in the book and then kind of share their stories, and hopefully they'll inspire people to no longer fear growing older and kind of look forward to that stage of life that has this incredible sense of freedom.
The man is building a major global media outfit. He is Ari Seth Cohen. His new book is Advanced Style, Older and Wiser. And what I like about it includes not just fabulous photos that capture the amazing spirit of his subjects, but now insightful quotes from these later in life fashion icons that will inspire you folks to be yourself, no matter how outrageous that might be. Ari Seth Cohen, thanks so much. Coming up, one of our very favorites, an inspiring story of survival unlike any other. That's next on Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by...
Even when we're growing bolder, we can all use a ride every now and then. Did you know that many Medicare Advantage Flex cards help cover the cost of Uber rides to appointments and important deliveries with Uber Eats like groceries and OTC medication? Learn more at uberhealth.com/card or call 1-866-827-4584.
My card stood hard when abstract threats to noble.
This is Growing Bolder with Mark Middleton and Bill Schaefer, and our next guest has a bachelor's degree from Syracuse, a master's degree from Harvard, and a PhD from Cal Berkeley. Bill, this is one smart chick.
One of the coolest people we have met. She's also a world-ranked master swimmer, one of the country's top health and wellness coaches, and a major fundraiser and an advocate for cancer research, something she unfortunately has a very personal interest in. As a three-time cancer survivor herself, let's say hi to Dr. Susan Helmrich. How are you, Susan?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Boy, it sure seems like you've had a great year. Lots of travel, lots of great family time, lots of swimming. Is it an exaggeration to say that you are never really thought you might even make it to 60?
That is not an exaggeration at all. I never, ever expected to see 60. So this was a big year for me, like in so many ways. I just, I think because the first time I had cancer, which was probably the most serious and the most aggressive cancer, I was 21 years old. So if someone at that time said, you will celebrate your 60th birthday, I didn't think I'd see 30.
And Susan, you make 60 look good. And just so folks understand, so we can get past this, you mentioned that you had a rare cancer at the age of 21, something directly related to your mother being prescribed DES, which is a synthetic hormone thought to prevent miscarriage. It was actually approved by the FDA without controlled studies. And even after it was proven to not only be ineffective, but highly toxic and carcinogenic, it remained on the market for over 15 years because it was a big moneymaker for more than 275 drug companies. Since then, you've had two other serious cancers, lung cancer, even though you've never smoked a cigarette, and pancreatic cancer. Do you think, Susan, that the DES exposure is somehow related to all three cancers?
Well, I do. Susan Helmrich, the person. Susan Helmrich, the epidemiologist, knows that there isn't a study out there in the world that could say that my other two cancers were related. So I feel that there has to have something happened, either in my immune system or my genetic makeup or something when I was in utero and I was exposed to that drug. It did something to me. For sure, the first cancer, we know epidemiologic studies show for sure that's what caused it. There isn't a doctor or an epidemiologist that would say the lung and the pancreas were related, but I believe something had to have happened because I've been one of those people all my life since I had cancer so young. I ate well, I exercised right, I never smoked, I never did drugs. I did all the right things, so I just, in my heart, I believe, yes. In my brain, I'm not so sure.
And nobody would be surprised, Susan, if you would have been a frail, housebound person for whatever days you had, but you're a championship swimmer. You've become a champion without most of a lung, without a gallbladder, your entire reproductive system, your duodenum, and I don't even know what that is, half of your pancreas, part of your stomach, bile ducts, lymph nodes. I mean, the list is incredible. How do you persist?
Well, you know, it's kind of like you put one foot in front of the other every single day, and you just keep going. And the last cancer, I will say, the pancreatic cancer was horrible, but I actually had the good kind of pancreatic cancer. Only 3% of all pancreatic cancers are neuroendocrine, which is what I had. I thought I was going to die from the surgery. That surgery was horrific. I was 23 days in the hospital. I didn't eat one thing for 23 days. I threw up about 8 times a day, and I thought that part was going to kill me, and I would never swim or walk or breathe again. And so you get out. I got out, and I was like, every day was like a training day. You know, I would walk a little bit further each day, and I would eat a little bit more each day, and little by little, one step at a time, I got to where I got when I met you guys.
And you know, we've enjoyed knowing you for a while, and I want to get to your swim thing real quickly, but tell us what your overall philosophy is now, Susan, when it comes to health and wellness. What's the basic message that you share with your clients?
You know, I really try to teach my clients and help them figure out a way of living that makes sense to them and that's healthy. And part of that healthy living is moving every day. And I get most of my clients go, do I have to exercise? And I say, are you crazy? That's the magic formula. You must exercise. And so even if I get them to walk an hour a day, that is my approach for my clients. For myself, an hour a day isn't nearly enough.
And one of the cool ways you motivate other people, Susan, is this organization you've been involved in a leadership role. It's Swim Across America. Tell us about that.
So Swim Across America is a national organization. We have 17 swims around the country. I am the director, co-director of the San Francisco Swim, where we jump in under the Golden Gate Bridge and we swim into San Francisco next to the St. Francis Yacht Club. It's about a mile and a half. But more than that, it's a challenge for so many people to raise money. They have to raise a minimum of $500, although we have some swimmers who raise thousands. Last year, we raised $500,000 in a morning, and we donate our money to pediatric cancer research at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals. And it's just, for me, because I had cancer when I was young, I've always wished, you know, I wasn't the researcher who would find a cure, but now I feel like it's a way for me to give back. And running this organization, I meet the most amazing people, and people who are really wanting, like me, to figure out a way, a small way to give back, and we really are making a difference.
And if anybody out there wants to help your cause, help you help others, how do they get in touch with you, Susan?
Well, I'm easy to find. I'm Susan at swimacrossamerica.org, and we have a website, swimacrossamerica.org, and we have swims all over the country, so wherever you are, you can jump in the water and help make a difference and make waves to fight cancer.
And folks, Bill and I had the pleasure of meeting Susan in person at the National Swimming Championships a few years ago. We've done a video on her. You really should watch it. Just go to growingbolder.com and search for Helmrich. That's H-E-L-M-R-I-C-H. Susan, I wish we had more time. Bill and I both keep up with you on Facebook. It certainly looks like you are savoring every moment, and that's something that we continue to learn from you as well, and that is don't take anything for granted and live in the moment. Coming up, what's behind the skyrocketing heroin epidemic? Prescription pain medications is the answer. If you don't think it could happen to you or a loved one, think again. That important message next on Growing Bolder.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Bolder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
Mark and Bill here on Growing Bolder, and you've probably heard the disturbing news reports that heroin use has been skyrocketing. In fact, it's now being described as an epidemic. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says heroin use has increased 63% between 2002 and 2013, and that heroin-related overdose deaths have quadrupled over that period. And it isn't just the homeless people that you see standing on street corners. Heroin use has now spread to every demographic in our society, with some of the highest growth rates among women, upper middle class, and people over 50.
Yeah, the CDC says addiction to prescription painkillers is what's fueling most of the rise in heroin use. People who are addicted to painkillers are making the switch to heroin because it's cheaper, doesn't require a prescription, and offers a similar high. In fact, their statistics show that those who are addicted to prescription opioid painkillers are 40 times more likely to become addicted to heroin, which is exactly why we wanted to speak with Dr. Martin Klepek. He's a highly respected psychiatrist, the Assistant Dean for Medical Education at the UCF College of Medicine. Good morning, Dr. Klepek. How are you?
I'm fine. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for your time. You know, the great thing about modern medicine is that we do have all of these powerful drugs to choose from that can alleviate chronic pain, which seems like almost everybody suffers from, everything from headaches to post-surgery. But as we now know, there is a significant downside to many of these drugs. What are these drugs that we're talking about, and what are your major concerns?
Well, some of the strongest pain medications we have are called opioids, things like morphine, oxycodone, fentanyl, methadone, hydrocodone, and others. And most of these have been around quite a long time. Part of the problem is that we don't have a whole lot of other tools in the toolbox, so to speak. So when doctors in the last few decades have been trying to help patients find pain relief, they didn't have a whole lot of options to turn to. And if you add to that the fact that doctors were also not fully aware of some of the potential downside of these medications, you start to see where it's a setup for a significant problem. And the good news is that I think folks are waking up. I mean, indeed, we've got a public health crisis going on with a fourfold increase in the number of deaths from prescription opioid medications. And just as you said, it appears that a majority of folks using heroin now began with prescription opioids. So it's as if this is a gateway to heroin for a significant number of people.
Can you help us, doctor, understand the difference between, gee, this stuff really seems to work for me, and an outright addiction?
Well, it can kind of happen gradually, almost imperceptibly. Part of the problem is that we haven't had a good sense of how long do you treat acute pain. And, you know, the new CDC guidelines are coming out and saying, you know, we probably need to keep prescription these kinds of strong medicines for acute pain, for a lot of cases, it would be 3 days or less, and only rarely more than 7 days. And, you know, sometimes when a doctor's seeing somebody in the office, they think, well, I'll prescribe a little extra just in case the pain continues longer than we're thinking. And then that can lead, that can snowball into continued use. So the longer you use the acute medications, the more you're setting yourself up for potential complications and even diversion of those pills onto the street.
We're speaking with Dr. Martin Klopik, who is a renowned, respected psychiatrist, the assistant dean for medical education at the UCF College of Medicine, about, you know, what the health industry is now calling an epidemic use of heroin, which for the most part has been fueled by the use of prescription drugs, primarily opioids. And, Doc, are some of us more susceptible to this rapid addiction? I know we learned that some people are alcoholics and they don't even need to take a drink because they can't. Is this something that a lot of people don't see coming? I mean, is there a psychological, a chemical, a genetic, an age-related component to this that doctors just can't foresee?
Well, I think you raise a good point. I think we're all vulnerable to some degree. Some of us may have a greater genetic underlying genetic vulnerability than others, but I think we're all vulnerable. These are just powerfully addicting medications.
Okay, that's from the patient side. How about the doctor side? I mean, this is nothing new. These dangers are well documented. So why is overprescription so common?
Well, again, there hasn't been a whole lot of other tools in the toolbox. And when all you have is a hammer, all your problems start to look like a nail. And the good news is that we are starting to get some alternative options. So non-opioid medications are perfectly fine for a large number of patients with chronic pain, and even non-pharmacologic interventions like physical therapy, exercise therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, biofeedback. These are all things that we're starting to educate our young doctors more and more about the non-opioid options for treatment of pain. And that's one of the great things about these new guidelines that have come from the CDC just recently on use of opioids for chronic pain. They're trying to share new evidence-based findings to help guide doctors in when to use opioids and when to use alternatives. And it's wonderful. And a large number of medical schools in the country have signed up and committed themselves to training our students with the very latest knowledge. So I feel hopeful about that. I mean, it's a terrible crisis right now, but I feel hopeful that we can do something about this. And part of it's through education of doctors, but also of the public.
You know, you make a great point, Doc, and I'd like to ask you to expand upon that just a little bit, because you really are in a unique position, not just because you are a thought leader on this issue, but you are an educator. I mean, you are working with tomorrow's doctors today. Now, what specifically is the UCF College of Medicine doing to help these young doctors learn how to prescribe and when not to prescribe these opioids?
Well, this was on our radar actually at least a year ago when we decided we wanted to review our entire curriculum on how we introduce this topic to our students. And they learn really throughout all 4 years about opioids. They start off in the first couple of years with a focus on the pharmacology of these medications, how they work, alternative medications. And so that's sort of the basic science foundation. And then in the third and fourth year, when they're actually in the hospitals and the clinic treating patients under supervision along with their attending doctors, they actually apply this knowledge directly to patient care, and they see what works and they see what doesn't. What we're going to do, especially in light of the new guidelines from the CDC, we're looking at our curriculum yet again and updating it and reinforcing and strengthening it wherever possible. Again, it's sort of a twofold thing. You need the basic knowledge, the facts, the latest research findings, but then you also have to have the opportunity to directly apply that to clinical care with actual patients. That's when it comes alive. That's when you really learn. You see what works and what doesn't. And so we're very committed to this.
Doc, in about 15 seconds or so, what should you do if you think maybe you did get hooked on your medicine or somebody you know?
talk to your doctor. If you see somebody that your concern's becoming addicted, share your concerns with that individual. I mean, strongly encourage them to talk to their doctor. If appropriate, offer to go with them to their doctor's office and ask the doctor for referral for a consultation with a substance abuse treatment center so that both the pain and the substance abuse can be successfully treated.
Boy, great advice, a great and timely topic, the epidemic of overuse of prescription pain medication. He is Dr. Martin Klopik, the Assistant Dean for Medical Education at the UCF College of Medicine. Thanks, Doc. And we leave you with this reminder on what Growing Boulder is really about. Our mission, folks, is simple, but it is important. What we're doing and why we want you to join the movement is this. Growing Boulder is about rebranding aging. We're changing the narrative that surrounds aging from limitation to liberation, from challenge to opportunity, from weakness to power, and from fear and regret to purpose and passion. And we're doing it by telling the stories of ordinary people who are now living extraordinary lives. People like you. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Boulder Radio Show is a production of Growing Boulder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Boulder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. Chief audio engineer is Mac Dula, and our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.